was chasing your direction. I was telling you no lies, and I was loving you when the words are said. Baby, I lose my mind.
Andy Gibb's world just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And remember, he has not yet hit his 20th birthday.
That's insane.
Gosh. It's insane. This is the album that produced that poster we just talked about. The one on my wall, the red satin shirt, the arms outstretched. Come on, girl. Let's do this.
Let's put on bathrobes.
Hello, world. Here's a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. A whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy.
Welcome to the Pop Culture Preservation Society, the podcast for people born in the Big Wheel generation who didn't have Tinder, but they did have Tiger Beat.
We believe our Gen X childhoods gave us unforgettable songs, stories, characters, and images. And if we don't talk about them, they'll disappear, like Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition.
And today, we're still saving one of Gen X's most legendary crushes, the baby brother of the Bee Gees, who filled up the whole spotlight all by himself, Andy Gibb.
I'm Carolyn.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Michelle. And we are your pop culture preservationists.
Welcome back to the continuation of our tribute to Andy Gibb. And every time I write that, I try to think of some kind of descriptor like Andy Gibb, the who's he, what's he, who did the blah, 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 blah. But then, I just can't because he kind of defies description. He's just Andy Gibb. That's all you need to say. And everyone knows who you're talking about. So welcome back to our tribute to the life of Andy Gibb. We're going to drop you right back in the spot where we left you last week, which was a discussion of the songs on his first album in the United States called Flowing Rivers. We discussed I Just Want to Be Your Everything, Words and Music, Too Many Looks in Your Eyes, Love is Thicker Than Water, Starlight. What was the other one?
Mm-hmm.
We did a lot.
Yeah, we did.
Oh, yeah, Let It Be Me.
Yeah.
Let it be me. Okay. Yeah, we did all that. And the song that was supposed to be his next single, which might be the Andy Gibbiest song of any song on any of his albums. The one that sounds the least like the Bee Gees and the most like him, the album's title track, Flowing Rivers. But it was withdrawn in favor of the tsunami that was to come.
Shadow Dancing, the single, is released in April of 1978, just 7 months after the Flowing Rivers album. It's crazy. Crazy fast.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 months before the album is released in June of 1978. And the world explodes. The song climbs to number one in the summer of 1978. Honestly, is it not the soundtrack of all of our summers of 78?
That is right.
Mm-hmm. It was not only the song of the summer, it was also the biggest song of 1978.
And that chart, the biggest songs of 1978, is Gibb dominated. So just to get a picture of how the Gibbs dominated the charts in 1978, here are the biggest songs of the year. Number one is Shadow Dancing, followed by Night Fever. Then you got Debbie Boone in there with You Light Up My Life. But then you come back to a Gibb song with Staying Alive. But wait, there's more. At number six, the sixth biggest selling song of the year is How Deep Is Your Love. Number eight is Love is Thicker Than Water. Number 11 is Grease. Number 14 is Emotion by Samantha Sang, written by Barry Gibb. It's just unbelievable. I'm not sure we'll ever see this in history ever again.
It's like the gibbiest year ever.
It's the gibbiest year ever. So Shadow Dancing continues to attract top-notch musicians. If you recall, Joe Walsh was on the Flowing Rivers album. And on Shadow Dancing, we have Don Felder, also from the Eagles, playing on the song, I Go For You. Da-da-na-na-na-na. And then you also have members of the band Firefall, who did the song, You Are the Woman That I've Always Dreamed Of.
I knew it from the start.
Right? Such a good song. All of those people are on the Shadow Dancing album. And of course, there are some Gibbs.
Mm-hmm.
So the single Shadow Dancing sends the album Shadow Dancing into the stratosphere where it produced another string of hits. Andy Gibb's world just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And remember, He has not yet hit his 20th birthday.
That's insane.
Gosh. It's insane. This is the album that produced that poster we just talked about. The one on my wall, the red satin shirt, the arms outstretched. Come on, girl. Let's do this.
Let's put on bathrobes.
Let's
walk
put on
around
bathrobes.
Our apartment.
That bathrobe fantasy, you guys, I'm not sure I ever thought about what was underneath the bathrobes.
No, because we're not at that age yet.
I couldn't get there. No. Right. That was me bumping up against the next stage, what would be imagining what's under the bathrobes.
Of course. Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, that image. And that image goes along with some of my favorite songs of all time. But do not ask me to choose a favorite because I cannot. I won't. I won't do it.
I can choose a favorite Andy Gibb song, and it's so unoriginal. But an easy favorite is I Just Want to Be Your Everything.
Sure,
that will always, always be. I will listen to that song 15 times on repeat to this day. Like, and it's on so many playlists. I'm going to tell you, though, I have maybe something that's a little bit of an unpopular opinion, but whatever. On Shadow Dancing is not my favorite of his songs, but Don't Throw It All Away on that album. Gives me just like shivers.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is about that song.
I do. And I'll talk about it later. I do.
Okay,
I know
good.
What it is
but
because I get the same shivers.
I don't dislike Shadow Dancing, but I don't put it in like my top four Andy Gibb songs.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mine are all at number one. They're all, it's a tie.
Oh, yeah.
It's a tie. It's all number one.
35 songs at number one.
Mm-hmm.
Michelle, I'm going to ride your coattails. And I'm going to say that my favorites were whatever was probably popular at the time and everyone was singing.
Yeah.
But if I had to pick one right now, I'd probably say Our Love, Don't Throw It All Away. Our Love.
It's a good one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that song is the ultimate love song. It will come put you into a trance, basically. It will put you into a love trance.
Ooh.
Is what it does.
Yeah, that song and How Deep Is Your Love are like,
yes.
They're such sexy songs.
They're cut from the same cloth. They really are. And it's okay that they're cut from the same cloth. This does not diminish Andy Gibb's contribution to the world. It is that synergy of his voice and his writing along with his brother's writing and his brother's production and his brother's backing vocals that produce something magic. And we are grateful for it. I will try and choose one favorite.
Oh.
I think my favorite today, at this moment in time, is Everlasting Love.
I've been here all your life, watching your crying game.
Oh,
and
that's a good one.
I know. Right? It's such a sweet, crushy song. It's such a happy, like you can feel it's a bright song. You can feel the brightness coming out of it. And I have such a good association with it. I'm driving in a pickup truck, sitting between my grandparents.
Oh.
And we're driving through rural Oregon. There are mountains on either side of us. I don't know where we're going, but wherever you go in rural Oregon, it's going to take you a long time to get there. You're not going to be in the truck for just a few minutes. You're going to be in the truck for a long time. And I'm very happy to be sharing this space with my grandparents, Art and Clara. And we turn on the radio, and we're searching for something to listen to. And my grandma's turning the knob. There are no buttons, remember? She's just turning
That's
the
right.
knob,
just
turning the knob.
And yep, then there's
lots
a song,
of,
and then...
And probably not a lot of stations in rural Oregon, too.
Not a lot. And she passes Everlasting Love. She goes past it. And I don't know if I did anything. I worked hard not to do anything because I didn't feel it was my place to request a song or a radio station. It was their car, and I didn't feel like I could say, oh, do that song. I just wasn't like that. I held my cards close to my chest. But something in me must have shifted, and my grandma turned it back.
Aw.
And my grandparents did not listen to popular music. My grandpa was a musician, and he had very strong opinions about what you should and should not listen to, and popular music was in the category of you should not listen to popular music. And yet my grandma turned it back to Everlasting Love, and I remember just like relaxing, like my whole body relaxed, and I remember feeling so grateful, wordlessly. I was wordlessly grateful to my grandma for picking up on whatever I was laying down. Mm-hmm. And like, it was like she knew, it was like she was reading my mind and she just turned it back. And we sat there in silence and nobody said a word. She didn't say, oh, do you like the song? Or, oh, who's this? Nobody said a word. We just drove along in the pickup truck listening to the song.
Core memory, right?
Yeah.
There.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love that.
But after all of this gargantuan success that has come from Flowing Rivers, that has come from Shadow Dancing, from this record-breaking string of hits that he has had, here's what Andy Gibbs says about Shadow Dancing. And this is quoted directly from Wikipedia. He says, I am so much more confident now after doing this second album, dealing with the pressures of proving to myself that the first one wasn't a fluke and that I could write a second album. So now I am a lot more confident. And although that is a positive statement he's making, this is the sentiment that would haunt him, mostly with regard to living up to his brothers, especially Barry. Barry was his idol. Was he successful on his own? Could he be successful on his own? Or is it just because of them? That is the demon that haunted Andy Gibb. Mm-hmm.
I read a quote this week from Andy that said, I didn't have any confidence. I always thought people were buying my records as an extension to the Bee Gees, and I never thought there was an individual thing in there that they liked.
Oh, God. And you know, the fact that he had to say that, that's what I think, this quote you read, Kristen, and then that one, Michelle. This is on the forefront of his mind. The fact that he's actually verbalizing this, like we would have all thought he was confident and
stuff. Well, the struggle though is on the front, because these quotes are so contradictory, right? The one Kristen said and the one.
Oh, yeah.
But you know, he's got this struggle that's just driving, I feel like, his life. I feel like when he says these things, like Kristen, you said, it had to have just been such a false narrative that he was trying to, you know, to portray. Because we know, and I'm using air quotes here because how could any of us really know, that he probably was not more confident. Barry actually said on that VH1 Behind the Music episode, that's my source right now, that Andy did not have the confidence he had early on when he was hungry and first starting out writing and performing. Barry said he was chasing something unattainable.
Which is really to be bigger than his brothers, not for the purpose of competition, but to seek approval from these men that he idolized so clearly. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to be the one who was lesser than them. And he needed some kind of proof that that was the case. And yet he got proof every day in every record sale. He got proof, but he just didn't believe it. And part of the story that is trotted out, I'm not going to say this is untrue, but I think it villainizes the Bee Gees a little bit, was that he wasn't asked to be one of the Bee Gees. That would have been the thing that would have solved his all of his problems. We know that that one thing couldn't solve all of his problems, but would it have made an impact? Because for him, the ultimate approval from his brothers would be being asked to be a member of the Bee Gees, which never happened. But there are so many reasons that that was never going to happen. Very logical reasons that actually show him as the greater talent. First and foremost, like we said before, he was the whole package on his own. Don't put Morris
separate.
Out front.
Yeah. Stop saying that.
I know. I'm sorry, okay, Morris.
But,
I love you.
But you guys, when I go back to my 1978-year-old self, I didn't see Andy Gibb as the fourth Bee Gee.
Yeah.
I knew who the Bee Gees were.
I did not.
And I knew who Andy Gibb was. Yeah. They're separate entities,
totally
in
separate.
My opinion. But yet Andy Gibb is constantly thinking he's connected. And I have to wonder, and this is just me wondering, you know, Barry, you know, the same producer, right? The same, he's writing so much of his stuff. I just always have to wonder if he could have ever completely gotten away, like, wrote an album where every single song was his own and he had a different producer and he was completely detached from the brothers.
Yeah.
As much as they, you know, seem to have love and respect and admiration for each other, I just have to wonder if that might have made a difference if he was a separate entity completely.
It would only
how could
do
you
that.
Be? How could you be?
How right? could you be? And it would only make a difference to his own internal, it would only work if he believed in himself, like chicken or the egg,
right?
I think that you could have made him a Bee Gee, and that original, I'm going to call it the original sin, that's not what it is, but the original thing that haunts him, it doesn't go away. He's always chasing it. And we say this a lot when we talk about people in the media. That speaks to mental illness. That is not a situational thing. Yes, you have this giant overshadowing by his brothers. You have this unique situation in which he could never catch up. He could never be as popular. Well, but he was. He was more popular. But he doesn't see
not
it.
It's because he doesn't
see it. That is where we see depression and anxiety and something that takes real work with a good therapist to get through. Getting that number one album by yourself wouldn't solve your problem.
Correct.
No, and when you know the road he is going down at starting at, you know, age 19, 20, and that just kept getting, you know, more intense and everything that we're going to talk about in a minute, that is an illness. That doesn't just happen, you know, like unrelated to anything else. It doesn't happen in isolation, right?
Right.
That is caused by, you know, it's a sickness. It's an illness.
Yeah.
And he had so many different signs of that. And it's tragic.
Again, it speaks to what I think of him being born into this family. And you're constantly just in their shadow chasing. Not to mention your legs aren't as long. I mean, even when you're little, and you're you're... That's the epitome. That's probably who's getting all the accolades. I mean, you see that, you know, from the parents as well as the society, culture, people.
Yeah.
And I just feel like that was so part of who he was when he stepped onto this planet that just kind of informed so many. I just want to be with you. I want to catch up with you. I want to be part of you. And what that can, I don't know how that can inform how you walk through the world. I think.
Well, and at the same time, what that means is that if he, let's say he did get the approval that he needed, let's say he did become one of the Bee Gees, let's say he did get Barry Gibb honoring him and telling him how talented he was and how good he was. You guys, all that happened. You think Barry Gibb didn't tell him he was talented every single day?
Exactly.
So it doesn't make a difference if you have this illness. I'm sure Barry Gibb beats himself up every day. Like, why didn't I help him understand how gifted he was? And I'm sorry, Barry, I'm not sure that you can make a change there.
Right.
Yeah, at some point you can't. At some point, living with someone with an addiction, at some point you have to absolve yourself of all that kind of responsibility.
Yeah, that's right.
I have a question to throw out there. This is just something to mulch on or munch on or whatever you do. But do you think maybe that Barry could have been living a little vicariously through Andy, because Barry wasn't going to be the solo act, really, you know, at least as far as we knew in the 70s and early 80s. I don't know.
Well, it was certainly an extenuation, an extension of
right.
him.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's total speculation, as is most of the stuff I'm saying about probably Andy.
And I think to a certain extent, all of our discussion, especially when we're talking about someone who had a mental illness that none of us can know. It has to be
sharing
our own feelings. We're not listeners. We're not trying to diagnose anybody or anything
for
like
sure
that.
Not.
We're just bringing our own feelings to the table and our own experiences.
Well, and there's so much more that we know today that we did not know then, so that we could make informed speculation.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Sure.
There are things that we can recognize now so easily, even though we're not diagnosing him, but we can see quite in ways that they didn't in 1978, what this problem is and how you deal with it. It's, you know, addiction does not exist in a vacuum. And it just breaks your heart.
You alone are the living thing that keeps me alive. And tomorrow, if I'm here without your love, you know I can't survive.
Only my love.
So Andy Gibb is the biggest star in the world. It was nothing short of a meteoric rise, fully eclipsing his brothers in less than a year. And here's what PETA has to say. But fame has its limitations and its obstacles. Another more modern observer of this human condition, the recently departed comic actor Matthew Perry of Friends fame, said in his 2022 autobiography, "You have to get famous to know that it's not the answer. And nobody who is not famous will ever truly believe that." spot on. Totally. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It is.
Andy was destined for fame, his talent too great to be denied. But fame was not the answer for him, and it never provided him the safety, security, and self-belief he longed for his entire life as a child growing up in the shadow of his brothers. He struggled from his mid-teens with drug use and alcoholism in an attempt to mask his pain and insecurity and deal with his mental health. This impacted not only his career, but also his relationships with his wife, daughter, family, significant partners, and lovers, band members, and employers. I mean, really everyone he had relationships with. It's so sad. And it's
just
what addiction does.
I want to say thank you to PETA for writing that because it is, I keep saying the word lovingly. I wish I could come up with another term, but everything is so lovingly rendered. It's as if she can see the lens through which her father saw, where he was seeking fame, but he had fame and he was still seeking fame. The fame was not filling him up. You need more fame. It was just this vicious cycle. And she understands it so clearly. I don't want to make any assumptions about PETA's existence, but I would imagine she's had a great deal of therapy to figure this all out. She writes this like a very studied person, right? A person who has really been working on this for her whole life. It is worth mentioning that at a certain point, his wife, Kim, says, I can't deal with this. I can't put up with this any longer. So they are married for such a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. And it is in that shadow dancing era where she learns that she's pregnant and he promises that he'll get better. He cannot. And she goes back to Australia, which is another very grown-up thing that we're asking of a child. She, too, was a child. And I think that was probably a very difficult decision she had to make and a very grown-up decision she had to make. And she was doing it for the sake of her child. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm guessing. I don't know PETA's mom. But she was living amongst all of this fame, the music industry. I'm sure she was seeing stars upon stars upon stars. And a lot of people would have been really starstruck by that and figured out how to stay. And she was like, I'm out of here. This is not working. So they divorce. At a very young age, I should say. Their marriage doesn't last very long. She goes back to Australia and PETA is born. Andy Gibb does not meet his daughter until she's 2 years old. Ugh. He will meet her in person only one time, which according to people in his world, in his band, the people who loved him, that this was a huge source of pain for him. I can't imagine what it would be like to be both of them, to be both Andy and PETA, and to be living in this situation. There are really no words for it. And at the same time, they were children trying to make these decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And therein lies, I'm assuming PETA, but therein lies the bulk of her therapy, just because I know it was the bulk of mine.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How do you not place blame? And how do you not place blame on a parent and say, you know, what about me?
What do you do with your anger?
What do you do with your anger? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kristen, what do you do?
Just tell me. Let me check my book.
Hold on. I'm just kidding.
So it is during this time that his addiction is really growing quite rapidly and dangerously. He is 20 years old. He has a young child in Australia that he hasn't seen. He will speak to her on the phone over the next 10 years occasionally. So PETA does feel like there was a continuing relationship. But of course, as you know, it's never enough. It's never, when you're the child, it's never enough.
I would love to know from PETA if those conversations were awkward for her or if I would love to talk to her about that. Like, did you feel awkward? Did you feel ashamed? Like, did you feel like you were supposed to be giving more to the relationship, even though you're a 7-year-old child, an 8-year-old child?
Right. You're a little kid. And I'm sure, as so many people our age know who have been in the same situation, who had an elusive father and got those occasional phone calls. Yeah. Was that an exciting thing? Was it a scary thing? Was it
It could be scary. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and it is during this time when he's just 20 years old and his addiction is growing rapidly that he is diagnosed with a heart problem. And this will be the little nugget of information that is not really shared with people too much. I feel like if this had been something that he attended to, if he were older, right? If he were mm-hmm. older and more mature, would he have been like, holy shit, I am ruining my heart with my drug problem. I've got to do something. Mm-hmm. But you're not a grown up.
Right.
And you're in the throes of addiction.
And also and you're unable.
Let's just push right. that to you're, the side.
If you're an addict, you're unable to do something without some That's serious right. help. Because let's not forget, you know, what's causing this is just a lot of pain, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Causing, I'm sure, escape, pain, whatever you want to mm-hmm. call it. I mean, there's a million reasons, but. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you don't want to feel the feeling that you're feeling. You'd want that to go away. You want to numb oh, it.
Yes, numb that's it, a right? really important yeah. point, Carolyn, because that right there is the central feature of addiction, right? Mm-hmm. I don't like mm-hmm. what I'm feeling. How do I make it go away? And if it's not going away, I'll just do more.
Right.
I'll just do more.
Mm-hmm. And so it's during this time after his marriage has fallen apart and his daughter is born, but he's really disconnected from that event, that he has linked with other women in the tabloids constantly. But where is the truth? I mean, do we really know? And at least for me, does it really matter now? Right. Back mm-hmm. then, that's always like, oh, who's Andy Gibb with? Because we right. didn't know he had a wife and a daughter. You know, where is the truth? Was he with Marie Osmond? You know, yes, we think he was. Olivia Newton-John, Susan George. I mean, there's so many different women who were linked to him in the tabloids, but Andy Gibb was not a Lothario. He truly seemed to be just looking for love. I mean, we don't know. Were some of these people just good friends? Andy once said, if I'm suggestive, it's in a nice way. Luckily, no one's ever been hurt. A few girls have passed out. That's all. So innocent. And he's darling. I don't know. It's just,
it is
this
darling.
Is another one of those situations yeah. where do we know? We know a little bit about Marie Osmond, and we're going to talk about her for just a minute. We know they met on the Donny and Marie show in October of 1978, and they sang a duet together, Sometimes When We Touch. They were babies.
Yeah.
She was 19. He was 20. And then they dated, which is a weird coupling, right?
It's weird. It is Mormon dating, which is not the same.
Yeah, right, side hugs. Right. Side hugs. Yeah. Duggar dating. Yeah. We call it Duggar dating.
No,
side hugs.
There's no drinking. There's no, right.
Well, I've got to tell you, that coupling and those duets, I went down a rabbit hole. And I've watched them several times, okay? You guys, these duets with Marie Osmond, I almost don't have words for them, okay? The Sometimes When We Touch, I don't know if you've watched it. There's this undeniable attraction, and it's sweet.
And sometimes when we touch, the honesty is too much, and I have to close my eyes and hide. I wanna hold you till I die, till we both break down and cry. I wanna hold you till the fear in me subsides.
There's nothing mm-hmm. like sexy
right,
about
they're
it.
Babies.
Yeah. Well, yes, but mm-hmm. it's like.
Although I guess he was already a husband and a father, so I guess
right,
he's not really
right.
a baby, but she
but
certainly
it
seemed to
seemed
be.
Like this was stars in our eyes, just really sweet and innocent, even though we're talking about Sometimes When We Touch kind of a thing. And maybe it was just me. But I was hooked. There is something extra on a different level, on a different plane with this. And then they sing. Suddenly, they have, gosh, I don't know, 5 or 6 that I have watched. You guys, go back. Watch it in slow motion if you have to. There is something undeniable about that, uh-huh. about that attraction. And it's so sad at the same time, because knowing what we know now, yes, it doesn't happen. It doesn't amount to anything, because I think much to what you just said, Kristen, it's probably Mormon dating. I think mm-hmm. we have mom and dad Osmond maybe hovering mm-hmm. over this.
Yeah.
I think mother and father put an end to that real quick.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I, as we have said, he had his addiction issue at the same time. I could just feel that Marie was so torn. I really watching those videos again, just look at it.
It's all right. Emotion, and I'm ready to sail any old
Sorry, I'm just acting this out here. I feel like these were like two star-crossed lovers, that if she had maybe been a different, it had been a different time, I don't know, that maybe they could have just Romeo and Juliet, they could have gotten together.
Yeah. And I don't think you're wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Reported by Marie Osmond herself, they cared for each other. They liked each other a lot. She's actually said too, I mean, he was out partying. She couldn't, you know, she couldn't drink Coca-Cola. She had to marry within the Mormon faith. She was definitely pressured to end things with him. Oh. And she said on many talk shows, you know, she had to take action to have him stop calling her because he cared for her. Did you guys see, did you then watch 4 years later, just 4 years later in 1982, they performed a duet on Solid Gold, and it's Just Once. Knowing that they cared for each other, it must have been so uncomfortable. He sings, I did my best, but I guess my best wasn't good enough.
Oh,
and he's looking at her. And then Marie starts singing, We're Back to Being Strangers, wondering if we ought to stay or head on out the door. And unlike that Donnie and Marie, one that you're talking about, Carolyn, watch the beginning when he starts, I did my best, but his eyes dart, like he cannot hold her gaze. And when she starts singing, she can't either. Her eyes flicker. But then they get more comfortable with it. And in my mind, I'm doing a Carolyn here. I'm constructing a whole story of they then realize, wait, we did mean something to each other, because once they get to the chorus and everything, they are locked. Their eyes are locked.
Just once, can we figure out what we keep doing wrong? Oh, why we never last forever long?
And you know, to this day, Marie Osmond has just wonderful, lovely. She says he's a beautiful man. I mean, this is a recent interview she did on like The Talk or The View or something, said he's a beautiful man. And I don't think she's not talking just about his good looks. She really, really cared for him.
Yeah. It's just, it breaks my heart.
And she is well aware of the difficulties that he had, which would be the things that people would really judge him for and not have such loving feelings.
Hey, everybody, a quick message. Today's episode is brought to you by Book of the Month, a monthly book subscription box that helps readers discover new books from up-and-coming authors.
The process of choosing your book is so easy and fun. Besides the website and app being really easy to navigate, the smaller but varied monthly selection, which always includes an anticipated new release, by the way, means I'm not overwhelmed with too many choices, and it's truly easy to make a decision. And let's be real, we're all about simplicity right now, aren't we?
Oh, definitely. So you guys, I was thrilled when I saw that this month's selections included a book I have been anticipating for over a year. I chose The Paradise Problem by Christina Loren. It is rom-com at its finest. Think Pretty Woman meets Succession.
Ooh. I chose Spitting Gold by Carmela Locus, about two shady spirit mediums in 19th century Paris. I mean, come on, you had me at shady spirit mediums, right? This is a brand new hardcover book, and I'm getting it for less than I could get it anywhere else.
And great news, you can get your first book for only $5 using the code PETALS when you order at bookofthemonth.com. That's PETALS.
You guys, we love Book of the Month, and we know you will too.
But I think he once commented that he and his brothers were the marrying kind. And I think that's such a strong, strong statement for somebody at such a young age. I mean, I think he was 19 or 20 or 21 when he said it. My brothers and I are the marrying kind. The Bee Gees have famously been married for decades and decades. They all had starter wives at the beginning when they were young and impulsive, you know, 19, and it lasted a year. And I think Barry Gibb's been married to the same woman since 1970. And Morris and Robin had long-term relationships like that too.
Yeah, they did.
And I think Andy Gibb fell into the same category, even though his marriage, his very, very, very young marriage, fell apart for very, very, very obvious reasons. I think what he desired was not to conquer women, but to have this connection with somebody like you're observing in these performances with Marie Osmond. And then even after these relationships would end, he would still be connected to these women. Yeah. They would always remain important people to each other. So he, for instance, he bought a yacht and called it My Marie long after they had broken up. He wow. had a racehorse named Livy's Choice, named after Olivia Newton-John. They never actually had a relationship, although people really wanted them to have a relationship or wanted to put them together. But she was 10 years right. older
that,
than he was.
To me, they, didn't you think that was yes. like, bit, you know, like crush on my big sister's yes. best friend kind of a
That's right. Very innocent, friendship oriented, but clearly very, very close. But people, of course, in the media want it to be something more. And so there was always speculation, and this could be true, that the male role in Xanadu was supposed to be Andy Gibb. Some people even say he had the role and he lost it because of his addiction. Mm-hmm. And I have always thought that that guy, whoever he is, I don't know who he is. Because nobody does. I have always thought that guy looked like Andy Gibb. Yeah. If it had been Andy Gibb, my God, can you imagine Xanadu with Olivia Newton-John and Andy Gibb on roller skates? Come on. Worth mentioning, though, that all of the women that he was linked with in the press, all of them speak of him so glowingly as if they love and adore him, even though they weren't romantic partners, or maybe they mm-hmm. were romantic partners in the past, but now they're not anymore. And generally that would produce some rancor.
Yeah.
Animosity. Doesn't appear that he made people no. feel any rancor.
Right. And it appears that it wasn't just these women who he had relationships with that talked so fondly of him. Everybody that commented on him talked about his kindness, how he mm-hmm. was empathetic, how he was just sensitive. All of these adjectives that, well, personally, I think would be wonderful in a man. But at the time, I'm not sure that these were qualities that we held up in a society as manly. To be sensitive, to be emotional about things. And I, again, can't help but wonder if this was another part of himself that he was trying to numb.
I think you're right, Carolyn. I think that that might be a common thread amongst men who suffer from addiction. A great deal of sensitivity, and you're not supposed to be that sensitive. And right. you're not supposed to have those kinds of feelings. You're supposed to be suave and be a cowboy and, you know, the whole Ronald Reagan Marlboro Man situation. And if you don't live up to that, then there's something wrong with you.
Right. And mm-hmm. again, as a woman, I find those qualities just attractive. And
yeah.
it doesn't surprise me that the women that he was involved with, even after romance, if there was or whatever, was yeah. gone, that this was something that kept their relationships just strong and kept them in touch. And like you said, all those women said that about him, that he was yeah. so kind.
And it, so what you can extrapolate from that is that his addiction kept those relationships from continuing.
Right.
But his person, his personality, the person who he was, kept those friendships intact.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, wow. What I mean, that's a legacy right there. That alone is a legacy.
And that just makes it even more clear and obvious that his addiction was the ugly monster, right?
Oh, right.
I think a lot of yes. people, because mm-hmm. of all the salacious tabloids, the headlines, the stories, yeah. equate that he was, right?
Exactly.
And it's separate. Yeah. It's separate yes. from him.
Mm-hmm.
And right. I think that's a really important thing to recognize.
Yeah. Well, and especially if you are in relationship with that person, if he is your father or, right, mm-hmm. if you can separate those two things, it'll go a long way to helping you seek forgiveness or, I mean, give forgiveness yeah. is what I'm saying. I would hope. In the biography of Andy Gibb, the one that I said that I wished I hadn't read, however, the author does say something interesting from Olivia Newton-John. He says, in our correspondence, she emphasized how sweet of a friend Andy was. Those were her exact words. Olivia wanted to not only honor Andy's memory, but protect it. He had his problems, but she would never, ever discuss them. She felt strongly that his legacy should be his music and what a remarkable talent he was. And it's easy to see why they were such good friends. Both were incredibly sweet people who loved making others happy with their music. They were comfortable in each other's company, and it showed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I bet he could be himself around her.
So he is, because of these relationships, because of his addiction, he is in the tabloids constantly. People seem more interested in his love life than in his music. And that's because after Shadow Dancing, he had trouble getting his next album out. This overwhelming difficulty that he had, his addiction, his self-doubt, his depression, it all gets in the way of his next album. The pressure to succeed Shadow Dancing is immense. What if he fails? So his next album, yeah, Carolyn just shuddered, right? Writer's block immediately would consume you, right? His next album is called After Dark. It's the one where the lightning strikes are coming through his thumbs. It takes too long to come out. He feels too much pressure. He has writer's block. He has trouble showing up for recording sessions. Barry Gibb ends up singing a lot of the vocals on the album. And Barry Gibb has written a larger share of the songs. So we don't get as much Andy Gibb on this album as we would like. It does produce a number four hit, Desire. You are desire. Honestly, I don't remember. I don't. Maybe they didn't play it in my area. I don't know. But I think that that time period where we're only seeing him in the tabloids and we're not getting more music, I think it had an effect on me in that I wasn't paying as much attention anymore. And when we know that when we're children and we hear about adult problems, ooh, we don't want to deal with that.
Right. And you know what else I kind of equated with the timing of all of this? This was when we were in that part of history with Just Say No to Drugs. Like, drugs was so bad and not even, it wasn't even on our radar why he might be doing them. We just knew that anybody who was doing any kind of drugs was bad. And so I know, at least for myself, that's probably when I just kind of switched it off. I'm like, oh, he's just another one. What a selfish jerk for, he got rich and famous. Now he's just doing coke off of, you know, glass coffee tables everywhere.
And you make assumptions and that you're right. That's exactly what we were taught. We knew nothing of addiction.
Correct.
We had no idea.
Yeah. It was easy as just say no. And he wouldn't say no was kind of just what, I mean, remember that was the big line. And
that's right. From Nancy Reagan.
Yeah.
Reports are that he tried so hard and so many times to just say no. But we all know that's not how addiction works, right? Mm-hmm. So the album After Dark, it doesn't sell as well, partially because of the aforementioned things, but also because he can't promote it. His tour is canceled when it's clear that his health is not good. He's not well enough. Will he show up night after night for concerts? And the decision belongs to Robert Stigwood, and he makes the call. There will be no After Dark tour. This is really when Andy Gibb loses me, and it makes sense. And the public stops paying attention to his music, I think.
Well, if you look, if you Google image Tiger Beat covers 1981, he's not on any of them. It's Matt Dillon. It's Scott Baio. You know, it's Michael Damian. It's because that also is what happens, right? You age out. Well, you know, he's all of what, 22?
He's 21, right? He's still cute as hell. So,
but he's not on the covers. Like he's gone from the teen magazines. There's no more posters. Yeah. There's
the Inquirer sure loves him.
Of course.
Right? So that's all feeding us too.
And even so, during this time, he's on TV constantly. Still, he's doing Bob Hope specials, talk shows, hosting Solid Gold with Marilyn McCoo, and it's on the John Davidson show, where he has his incredible meet cute with Victoria Principal. Our pal John Davidson orchestrated this, you guys. That's amazing. So the story is this. Andy had publicly said he had a crush on Pam from Dallas, Victoria Principal. And she'd heard he had said that. So she had written him a letter thanking him for his very kind, lovely words. And she stamped it, put it in her purse, but never mailed it. So somehow John manages to have her come out when Andy is a guest on his show. And if you go on YouTube and watch the clip, it's not only incredible, but it's adorable. He's like speechless and he's obviously starstruck and enamored with her. It's very clear that he has a crush on her. And the story is 3 days later, they went out on their first date. And that is, despite the age difference that a lot of people criticized, I think she was 8 or 9 years older than him, it was a true love story for them. Yeah. I really think it was.
And that that clip of the John Davidson show is really where you can see who he is for real, because they surprised him. They really surprised him. And he really is the boy next door. He is like a kid in your class who has a crush on somebody. Mm-hmm. And really it's cute. Really, and she's kind of quite adorable.
She's kind of a little bit, I think there was some instant chemistry, because she's a little flustered as well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The tabloids love this story. They want this romance to be something they can keep churning out, putting on the cover. But the addiction is still present, and the relationship isn't going to last.
So basically, I mean, there's a lot of, again, is it speculation? I don't know, that they did drugs together, right? And so I think then that people, right. So people often portray Victoria Principal as the villain, because she ultimately, it got to a point where she ultimately, regardless of if they did drugs together or not, it got to a point where she gave him an ultimatum. She says, it's the drugs or it's me. And she says, as much as she knows in her heart, he wanted and would have chosen her.
Yeah.
He couldn't. He chose the drugs. I don't know how that makes her a villain. If that ultimatum led him to spiral, those were his choices and his illness that, you know, she's not responsible for that. Apparently he was despondent.
And that she understands that it was not him and that it was the addiction, because she clearly says, I know he wanted to choose me.
She does.
But he couldn't. And that's where she lays down her boundary and they break up. This is where she becomes the villain, because they blame his drug addiction on her, that she left him and it sent him into a spiral of addiction. And she even has said that she kept her mouth shut during all of that. She could have spoken up and she could have said, that's not how it happened, but she felt to do that would re-injure him.
Right.
So people, they just love him so much and they want to protect him so much. It really says something about who he was, that they went out of their way to make sure that even in when he did horrifically hurtful things, that they're still trying to protect him. So that was something that Peta Gibb Weber really wanted us to emphasize, that she does not hold anything in her heart but love for Victoria Principal. And I'm going to read to you what she says. I have gotten to know Victoria well, and that she is a kind and good woman and who did everything she could in her time with my father to save him from himself. She has all the love and gratitude in my heart and is no means to blame for anything that happened to my father. The media have been so cruel to her. No woman should be made to take responsibility for the fate of a man she chose to love.
Yes. And, you know, it's the media again, because we don't know that he has struggled basically all of his life. It almost seems like, oh, we've got all the ingredients for a great story. This older woman, she's on Dallas, and now there are drugs. But the addictive things were all along. But when we, as the, you know, the readers of National Enquirer see, oh, look what happened. Of course it's her fault.
Yeah.
Oh, that's just heartbreaking. And I'm so glad that PETA has that relationship with her and recognizes.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes.
That's amazing. That she really wants people to know, really, that it's important to her that Victoria Principal is recognized for what she did. And I think we talked about in one of our Encore episodes about the tribute that Victoria Principal did just days ago on Andy Gibb's birthday. She posted posted a video of her throwing roses into the ocean on his birthday. And she didn't even put his name. She just put some emojis. But everybody knows what this is. She is paying tribute to this man that she had a 1 or 2 year long relationship 45 years ago.
Yeah, it wasn't even 2 years. It wasn't.
Right. It wasn't even 2 years long. And who was in the throes of an addiction that certainly must have caused her a great deal of pain. And yet she has this love in her heart still to this day. It blows my mind. It blows my mind.
No, I agree.
Okay, so, but despite this difficulty, Andy Gibb continues to get on the horse. He maybe doesn't need to record albums. Maybe he doesn't need to do music in this way. Maybe he can be a stage actor instead. And he wins the role of Frederick in the LA revival of Gilbert and Sullivan's Pirates of Penzance. And he he's good.
My eyes are fully open to my awful situation. I must go at once to Mabel and she'll make her a narration. I shall tell her I am bound by duty and my moral senses. Then I don't know what to do about the pending consequences. Now I do not wish to perish by the sword or by the dagger, but a pirate must indulge in little fun of a smile. What a tool of compliment my vanity would flatter, but I gotta go tonight.
His co-star is Pam Dauber of Mork and Mindy fame, who is a trained opera singer, and she's also instantly enamored of him and his talent. She becomes a forever friend and fan of Andy Gibb. And this turn as Frederick in Pirates is a comeback of sorts, and his role in Pirates leads to one of the most important developments of his career. He's cast in the Broadway production of Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat.
May I return.
But the beast continues to rear its ugly head. All of those opportunities dissipate when he has trouble showing up. Solid Gold, Joseph, he's let go when they can't rely on him. Despite the fact that he's getting great reviews and people love him. This makes me so sad as I'm reading it. It's just like, oh gosh, why can you see that? At one point, there was even talk of a Tony nomination for Joseph. But we know that depression and addiction are liars, and they don't allow you to believe that you are a good and worthy person. And gosh, that's kind of what I said before. There's nothing that you're going to believe that you're a good and worthy person, no matter how many people tell you.
It doesn't matter.
No.
And it doesn't matter if you get nominated for a Tony.
No.
You still think you don't deserve to be on that stage. And oftentimes they say, he wouldn't be showing up for a performance and he would be locked in his room and people are trying to get him out of his room and he just couldn't leave his room. And again, that's a hallmark of depression. This is not just a single beast, right? We have a very deep and difficult mental illness and we don't know if he was treated in any way, but we do know that in that era,
right,
therapy was not the thing that it is today. Treatment for depression is not the thing that it is today. I just wish that they had had the treatments back then that they do now. I really do. Mm-hmm. So throughout all of this tumult, no matter how much difficulty he caused personally and professionally, people always talk about him in loving ways. It's unusual and notable given what addiction especially can do to relationships. So highly unusual.
It is, because you think about, especially when he's not showing up for performances and plays, the number of people that was affecting their job, right, their work,
yeah,
their paycheck,
yeah,
their whatever, mm-hmm, and people still talk about him. And
poor Marilyn McCoo.
Ways.
How often did she end up hosting Solid Gold by herself on mm-hmm a moment's notice because he didn't mm-hmm show up? And you don't hear her saying anything badly about
right. Which to about me Andy points again. Out that he did show that real Andy, enough
yes
times and often yeah enough that people could tell, they could recognize that this other monster beast that we're talking about, that was a different entity. That was not Andy, if that makes sense.
Yeah, uh-huh, it does. It makes uh-huh perfect sense, because sometimes you can't discriminate between the two. The producer of Solid Gold, Brad Lackman, said, "Andy was a very charming, vulnerable, and charismatic performer. He clearly meant well. He wasn't being difficult. He was going through problems he couldn't deal with. He wanted everyone to love him. He had so much going for him, and he just couldn't believe it."
Mm-hmm. Oh, my heart hurts.
I mean, people love Andy Gibb. And PETA, I think she knows. I think she knows that. And she says it like this on her website. "Andy was quite simply loved by everyone who knew him, and you would be hard-pressed to find anyone to speak of him as anything other than one of the kindest humans they ever knew. His demons were too much for him in the end, and Andy passed away 5 days after his 30th birthday in Oxfordshire, England, from myocarditis, a heart condition brought about by his years of constant drug abuse. That day was the day that my childhood died."
Aw.
Mm-hmm. "It's one of the handful of days that has really lodged in my heart, and it's for a variety of reasons. It's not just the death of a celebrity. A lot of it is all the things that we just talked about right now. about who he was as a person. And I think those of us who fell in love with him, I'm putting, you know, quotes around it, those of us who fell in love with him, I think we fell in love with those parts too. I think we knew that about him, the nice part, the boy next door part, the kind part, the shy part, the humble part. We all knew that too. And so that goes along with the sadness when he died. I was with my friend Colleen and my friend Martha on the day that he died. We were sophomores in college, and it's a day that we hold dear in our history. We're still friends today, and my friend Colleen sent me this message when I told her that we were doing this episode. She said, "Andy was the first celebrity crush I lost. It was March 1988, my sophomore year in college. I don't remember who told me, but initially I thought it was a terrible joke and couldn't figure out why anyone would pull such a stupid prank. And when I realized it was true, my stomach churned and utter sadness began to sink in. I remember sitting in Kristen's dorm room knowing I would never be his everything."
Oh,
I know. Colleen. "Day moved into evening, but time felt suspended as we felt the ache of his death. I'm sure there were papers to write and chapters to read, but none of that mattered. Andy Gibb, the man who I would never meet, was gone. We had a go-to truck stop for late-night studying called the Big Steer. That night, we took no books, just our heavy hearts, and we ate disco fries with cheese. We drank weak coffee and mourned the loss of our teen heartthrob." And I have to say, I am so grateful to Colleen and to Martha for that day, because I needed to be with people who felt the same as me on that day. Mm-hmm. And we sat there in that stupid diner until the middle of the night, kind of just staring at each other.
It was had to have been so surreal for you and unbelievable. But to have those friends with you to grieve together had to have been so important.
It was. I'll never forget it. And I have in my mind, I feel like I heard the news and I opened my door and I put my face out into the hallway and there was Colleen looking back at me.
Yeah.
Like in disbelief. And we just gravitated toward one another. Yeah.
And, you know, I hate to say this, but I believe that the day, you know, when I heard, I was like, well, what do you expect when you do drugs? I mean, honestly, I was not sympathetic or empathetic at all at that point, just because I didn't know all of this stuff. And it was just kind of the, I don't know, the tape running through my head that, yeah, these celebrities who think, you know, they're all that, they have all this money, they do drugs. I mean, it wasn't even a drug overdose that he died from. I mean, it was from the myocarditis, but I venture to say that was kind of hidden in some of the news, or I just ignored
it.
Or I was just like, of course, you know, they might've said drugs contributed or something. I was like, yep. And I'm embarrassed about that, but that's kind of how I probably think I took the information in. I wasn't surprised.
The tabloids immediately picked up on the fact that it was a cocaine overdose, which was not true. In fact, he had been to rehab and he had actually gotten a record deal and he was starting to write music. And again, the writer's block was haunting him. He could not get out from underneath this pressure of, will I be able to live up to other people's expectations? And this heart problem that he had had for 10 years that really nobody knew about was causing him a great deal of pain. And they took him to the hospital several times during that week. And in an instant, in a single instant, the doctor asked him a question, turned around, turned back, and he had breathed his last breath. That's it.
And this is where we have to remember that Andy Gibb's death wasn't just tragic for us. A family lost their youngest child after trying for years to help and watching his decline. And PETA lost her dad at just 10 years old, which is a story I'm super familiar with. Not just the losing her dad at 10, but hardly ever seeing him and having an image of him in her mind, in my mind, that only magnifies since their death. The constant wondering of what if he'd lived? And it's a lifelong hole that honestly never can be filled because we don't have enough memories to fill it.
Oh, wow.
Oh, Michelle.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah.
Yeah, these are people's lives that we're talking about, right? Why am I focusing on this very sad part? I think it's because it helps me it helps me acknowledge who he was, because so many of the things that people say just are more testament to who he was and that people loved him so much. And then when I see that people loved him, then that makes me feel good that he was loved. And so this quote in particular stuck with me. This is from Morris. He says, "The loneliest thing I felt was when his coffin was left outside the wall where they put the coffin inside. And we were driving away, and I looked at the wall, and I saw no one else was there, just his coffin lying there against the wall, and I felt like he'd been abandoned. Mm-hmm. And we all wanted to go back and just stay with him because he was by himself."
They're still taking care of him, you know?
Yeah. That was their little brother.
Oh, yeah.
This is very, this is, and I think, right, we have to kind of pull ourselves together here.
You know, I do have to say that I am so grateful that we did this episode. My initial kind of thought was, okay, yeah, Kristen really wants to do it. Andy Gibb was a big deal. My sister, you know, had his poster on the wall. But it became something so much more, as some of these episodes do. I was so touched. I did a lot of actual journaling about this as I was doing some research. I love Andy Gibb. I'm so sad he isn't still here. I love his music. I printed out some of the lyrics. I'm so grateful for this opportunity, because otherwise I would have never learned some of the things I learned. Just it touched me in a way that I was not expecting, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful that we did this, because as I said, I am in love, and I might just hang that Speedo picture up. I might get it blown up. And just hang it right above my computer.
Mm-hmm. And that surprised me too, Carolyn, because I also took this on like, oh, this is Kristen's crush, and I'm going to bring these guys along with me. But you both saw his humanity, and you both were introduced to his music really for the first time, even though it impacted you in 1977, you now have that with you. His legacy lives on in the two of you, even though you're coming to it just now. I mean, it really makes me feel happy.
Well, PETA says it so perfectly. A son, husband, father, lover, brother, uncle, and beloved friend, and now also, in his afterlife, a grandfather of two. It's easy to forget that Andy was so much more than just a musician, an actor. He was a great lover of animals, a keen fisherman and water lover in general, and an enthusiastic and capable photographer. In the period before his passing, he achieved his dream to become a licensed pilot. Although his passion for music was undeniable, this outstanding young man was lost to us far too soon, leaving many of us to wonder what may have become of his all too short life if he had been given the opportunity to pursue one of these other passions. We wouldn't have the gift and legacy of his music, but maybe his loving family and friends would still have him.
Ouch.
And then she ends by saying, Andy Gibb was the brightest star in the sky for a period in musical history we can never forget. In the immortal words of Bernie Taupin, your candle burned out long before your legend ever did.
Yeah. What could he have done? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the fact that she said, what if he wasn't a musician? What if he had pursued one of these other things?
Right. We
don't know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So here is my new fantasy. In the afterlife, Andy Gibb is proud of himself. He feels the love. I'm going to cry now. He feels the love of his daughter, and he's able to love her back in ways he wasn't able to while he was here. He sees clearly the value of his music, and he feels confident and secure in who he is and what he has to offer the world. In the afterlife, he sees what other people saw in him, and he's happy. I don't have access to the afterlife, but I have every reason to believe that this can be true. Thank you for listening today and going on this journey with us. May you, too, see your value each and every day.
Thank you to each and every one of you for your support of this podcast, especially to those of you who support us with your monthly donations on Patreon and your one-time donations on our website. Today, you helped us honor a fellow human being who deserves this hour of your time.
And if you or someone you know is suffering from depression or addiction, please know that help is out there. Text your 5-digit zip code to 435-748. That's help for you. To reach a confidential treatment referral hotline.
In the meantime, let's raise our glasses for a toast to the life and legacy of Mr. Andrew Roy Gibb.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
The information, opinions, and comments expressed on the Pop Culture Preservation Society podcast belong solely to Carolyn, the Crushologist, and Hello Newman, and are in no way representative of our employers or affiliates, and though we truly believe we are always right, there is always a first time. The PCPS is written, produced, and recorded in Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of the fictional WJM Studios and our beloved Mary Richards. Nanu Nanu, keep on truckin', and may the force be with you.